This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome once again to our Friday Pitch-In. Coming up, we'll hear from the wilderness manager who, along with an Indiana ranger, picked up national recognition for their work in the Hoosier National Forest. We'll hear just how much visitation the Charles C. Deem Wilderness is getting amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Later, an update on Side Effects Public Media's coverage of Indiana's prison system. I talked to reporter Jake Harper about a facility that's having a particularly tough time keeping staff. Some former employees offer up some insight as to why. And later, just in time for Halloween, the IU Kokomo professor who was asked to produce an Audible original lecture series on the life, works, and legacy of horror master Edgar Allan Poe. But first, the week that was and still is, though not for long, with our very own Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer who's joining us virtually, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren. Lauren, are you there? I think you're still muted. Is Lauren there? Are we having trouble with Lauren? I think we might need to get Lauren on. Uh-oh. Anyway,
can you hear me?
There she is. How's it going?
It is going. How about yourself?
Not too bad. Although it's been a rough week, as have been the last, three, four now amid the COVID-19 pandemic. What do we know about the numbers?
Yeah. So as of noon today, 4,050 people have been confirmed to have died from COVID-19. There are more than 175,000 confirmed cases, and more than 1.6 million Hoosiers have been tested. Today's new cases at 3,205 are the second highest single day reported behind yesterday's 3,649 new cases. Yesterday's total, in fact, is the eighth new one-day record set since the state moved to stage five of its reopening plan. Over the last week, the state has reported 92 deaths, which is back in late May numbers for the number of deaths. And more than 1,600 Hoosiers are hospitalized with COVID-19, the most since early May. Yesterday's total, today it dropped ever so slightly, but yesterday's total was the third highest since the state started releasing those numbers. Indiana's seven-day average for cases has increased by 204% since the state moved to stage five. And in that same time period, 12 counties have more than doubled the number of their number of reported cases. And Fountain, Park, and Warren counties have all seen increases greater than 150%.
And we can't really point to more testing or anything like that to explain these numbers. These are just simply the way it looks right now. It's not great.
It is a surge. Surge is a loaded term because we've used it as a very technical term, but there has been a significant increase in new cases that doesn't match up perfectly with increases in testing and increases in new individuals being tested.
We hit another sobering milestone this week in the COVID-19 pandemic. What was that?
Yeah, yesterday I got to do a bunch of sad math. Yesterday we hit 4,000 confirmed deaths. It was kind of an inevitability compared to the new cases numbers that we're seeing. But of the 4,050 Hoosiers who are confirmed to have died from COVID-19, 57.3% are from long-term care facilities. State health officials say there are an additional 236 suspected COVID-19 deaths where a test wasn't administered, but healthcare professionals believe the person had the virus. What is important to note, though, is that the rate of newly reported deaths had actually significantly slowed at the end of the summer, averaging around 10 deaths per day from the end of June until the middle of September. But since mid-September, Indiana's reported deaths have continued to grow with 192 deaths reported in the last week. And that recent increase has put the state's weekly death toll in the same range that it was in late May. Since moving to stage five, the state has reported 634 new deaths. Actually, that is a little bit shy of how many new deaths we've reported. Add 26 to that number.
650. 660.
660. Lake St. Joseph and Vandenberg counties are all reporting more than 40 deaths each in that time frame. But more, you know, that more populous counties aren't exclusively experiencing this increase in deaths. For example, Pike County, which has seen a 130% increase in new cases, has also had 17 new deaths since the state went to stage five. Before September, it had had one.
When we look at that interactive map at coronavirus.in.gov, I can't remember the colors that they're using, but is it just a sea of red or is it splotchy red all over the state now?
It's mostly orange, which is the second highest, but it is mostly orange where, you know, we're seeing all of these increases in cases. We're seeing it across the map. I actually created a new layer for maps that you see embedded in stories from Indiana Public Broadcasting that has a layer that's specifically dedicated to a percent increase since moving to stage five. So, you know, because everything is arbitrary, September 26th is where we are taking that move. And what's really fascinating is seeing that for the most part, central Indiana is faring a lot better than the rest of the state. But it is scattered across, you know, more rural counties, more urban counties, more suburban counties. It is a statewide problem that seems to be happening right now.
And I really appreciate that work that you've done and been doing to go above and beyond what's provided by the state and improve the visual representation for what the pandemic is doing to Indiana. And, of course, you can go to your Indiana Public Broadcasting Station's website and look for some of those stories. And, again, to see the state resources, go to coronavirus.in.gov. That map, that color-coded map, is really, really user-friendly and really, really easy to tell what's going on where you are. So we heard a little bit this week about plans for a vaccine. What do we know?
Yeah, so I believe it was actually at the end of last week, Side Effects Public Media's Carter Barrett did a really great story about, you know, a draft of what the state's vaccine plans are. But we got a little bit more information this week from State Health Commissioner Chris Box. She said a COVID-19 vaccine could actually be available for some Hoosiers as early as mid to late November. She said federal officials recently told Indiana to prepare for initial shipments as early as next month, which would be a vaccine from Pfizer. I believe it's a two-step, it requires refrigeration. So there's a handful of things that make that messier and less likely that, you know, we will have, you know, vaccine in hand in mid to late November, but it is possible, maybe not probable. Box said a second vaccine from Moderna could be available as early as December, but neither has gotten FDA approval, which Box said the state will wait to examine before any distribution. Very few doses of the vaccine will be available early on, and the state has developed a distribution plan with healthcare workers targeted as the first recipients.
And everything I've seen on that distribution plan seems I agree with who is going to be getting the vaccine when. So thanks for that update. The gubernatorial candidates and, of course, the incumbent faced off again this week in the last gubernatorial debate. What happened?
Yeah, Governor Eric Holcomb's challengers, Democrat Dr. Woody Myers and Libertarian Donald Rainwater, were very much on the attack in the last gubernatorial debate before the election. Hoosiers, of course, got their chance Tuesday to hear candidates' views on topics, everything from marijuana legalization and redistricting reform to racial inequity and broadband access. Holcomb's strategy was very much to stay the course, maintaining the status quo platforms of his administration so far. Myers' primary angle of attack was that Holcomb hadn't done enough to address the state's challenges with a glaring example of COVID-19. And again, Dr. Myers is the former state health commissioner for Indiana. Makes sense. And then Donald Rainwater, the Libertarian candidate, opened a fire on Holcomb for the first few minutes of the debate and really asked conservative Hoosiers if their lives and, you know, personal economics had improved under the incumbent governor.
Okay. And on the, news of marijuana legalization, the attorney general candidate on the Democrat side, Jonathan Weinzapfel, just took to the stage, I believe, at the Indianapolis City County building. With Marion County Prosecutor Ryan Mears in support of legalizing recreational marijuana in the state. So more marijuana news happening today, just an hour or so ago, I believe, downtown Indianapolis. And of course, that is a race to watch next week. And speaking of races to watch and ways to cast your ballot, what did we find out this week about mail-in ballots?
So about 100,000 vote-by-mail ballots still haven't been returned to Indiana County election administrators, with just days to go before they're due. I do need to say right at the top, if your ballot is not received by your county administrator by noon on election day, it will not be counted. It has to be in their hands by noon. So that is the deadline. There is no wiggle room. That is Indiana law by noon. More than 560,000 Hoosiers requested mail-in ballots for the November election, which is a record for Indiana. And more than 460,000 of those ballots have been returned. But if you are still holding on to it, putting that ballot in the mail is not a good idea by any stretch of the imagination. The U.S. Postal Office says it is unlikely that it will get to your county election administrator by noon on election day. But Indiana law says that you are able to return it in person. You or a member of your household can return that mail-in ballot in person to your county election administrator's office. The election guide that I put together actually has a database of the mailing addresses and the physical locations of all of the county administrator offices in the state, organized by county. So you can find that address, you can find who you need to give this to, and make sure that you get it in. There is another option on election day. You can bring your mail-in ballot to your polling place, have it invalidated, and then cast a new ballot in person.
Ah, okay. All right. So that is one way that you can still vote if you've not turned it in. Bring it in on election day, invalidate it, and cast your ballot there. And I'm sure, Lauren, that if I gave you more time, you'd say, if you thought this week sounded busy, just wait until next Friday. But we'll check in again in a week. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, the pandemic is causing stress on Indiana's only congressionally designated wilderness. I talked to the Hoosier National Forest manager, who was recently recognized as a champion of wilderness stewardship. I'm Matt Pelser, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Two of the people who manage and maintain Indiana's only designated wilderness are being recognized nationally. The Bob Marshall Award for Individual Champion of Wilderness Stewardship was presented to Wilderness Ranger Rod Fall and District Recreation and Wilderness Manager Stacy Duke. Stacy joins us now. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here today.
So this award is a mouthful. Can you sum up what it means?
Sure, yes. Rod Fall and I, both Hoosier National Forest employees. As you mentioned, Rod is the wilderness ranger for the Charles C. Deem Wilderness, and I serve as the wilderness manager for our wilderness on the forest. And the Forest Service, the U.S. Forest Service, recognizes individuals each year for outstanding work and efforts towards wilderness stewardship and managing wilderness. So Rod and I were lucky to be selected and honored just recently with this national recognition for work that we have been completing for quite some time, but the award was specific to work completed in 2019.
So when we talk about Indiana's only designated wilderness, we're talking about the Charles C. Deem Wilderness just south of Lake Monroe, as you mentioned, and can you tell me a little bit about the area?
Sure. The Charles C. Deem Wilderness is the only congressionally designated wilderness in the state of Indiana. So it's incredibly special and very unique for a variety of reasons. Indiana is struggling a bit because for our state as a whole, we only have about 4% public land. However, we still have plenty of folks wanting to go out and use the public lands. So we work very hard to provide what wilderness is supposed to offer, which is a natural setting. It should provide opportunities of solitude. We're not allowed to use mechanized or motorized equipment to maintain trails. However, we are struggling a bit because our wilderness, for a lack of better expression, is often referred to as being loved to death because it is a popular area. We get a lot of visitation. Most folks do an outstanding job of leaving no trace and practicing low-impact recreation. However, we still experience substantial impacts on the ground to the point where we're dealing with issues that really are not sustainable from a recreation resource management perspective. So we're hopeful by sharing information today and in other ways, such as our social media, that we can get good messaging out to folks on how to minimize their impacts while still enjoying this special resource of wilderness.
Yeah, and we're glad to be that forum to do that. So, I mean, what kinds of problems are you talking about? Do you have rangers going out there picking paper? Is there litter? Are there other issues?
Yeah, just about any impact that you could think of regarding camping and using public lands we are experiencing, particularly this year with an uptick in use because of the pandemic. Recreationists are flocking to public lands, so we're getting increased use. Again, we've had impacts for several years now, but it's a little extra concerning this year with added usage. Some of the impacts that we're continuing to see, we have designated campsites along the shoreline of Monroe Lake. These sites happen to be the only designated campsites on the shoreline of the lake, so obviously a very attractive area for folks to visit and camp. But because of high use, we're getting an increase of live trees being cut for firewood. Mm. Campers will take rocks from historic structures to use for fire pit rings, which we strongly discourage because most of our historic sites actually fall under the National Historic Preservation Act, so they're protected. So we just really encourage folks to leave things as natural as possible, pack out all their trash, make sure they follow the rules and regulations, check out the Leave No Trace program. This program tiers to a variety of habitats, locations, and recreation pursuits, and provides a variety of tips and techniques to practice to help minimize your impacts. Something else to mention, we have a group size limitation of 10 in the wilderness. We also ask that if you're not camping in an actual designated site that has a sign indicating that it's a designated site, that you must follow the rules and regulations, which indicate that you cannot camp within 100 feet of a water source or a trail.
So there are designated campsites, but you can really kind of camp anywhere as long as you're following that rule.
That's correct. As long as you're following the rules and regulations for camping and then combining that with Leave No Trace practices, you're good to go.
And can you break down the 7 Leave No Trace principles or just mention them perhaps?
Yeah, there's 7 principles. The first principle starts with plan ahead and prepare. And that, in my opinion, is the absolute most important of the 7 principles, because as we all know, anything that you're preparing for or planning for in the future, the amount of time and effort you put into that is going to have a direct impact on not only your experience, but also how well you're going to be able to practice and follow Leave No Trace. So, you know, things that folks can do is like our Facebook page. We send out routine information about the National Forest and the wilderness on our Facebook page. We also have a really good website that is pretty user-friendly to obtain information on rules and regulations. Of course, things like planning for weather, planning for your group size, all those components go into that first principle. And then the other 6 principles, there's one on traveling and camping on durable surfaces. So, you know, sticking to the trail if there is a trail, sticking to a designated campsite if there's one available, because that spot has already been impacted. Other principles relate to minimizing campfire impacts and keeping your campfire small, but also ensuring that campfires are actually permitted. Sometimes we have a fire ban depending on how dry it is. So again, checking in advance on those kinds of things. Regarding the cultural resources in the forest, another principle within Leave No Trace is leaving what you find. Even kids love to go out and pick flowers and collect arrowheads and take things home to put on their shelf. But for a congressionally designated wilderness, all of those components, artifacts, rocks, flowers, are integral to the wilderness character of that area. So we really, really, really encourage folks to just take a picture and leave it where you found it. If it's truly an artifact or you think it's something that's historic, you can always reach out to our office and send us a picture so that we can confirm that or not. Respecting other visitors, that's a huge one right now because of the uptick of use with COVID. Keeping your noise down, respecting group size limitations, and so on. But also we have to remember that because of the increase of use, we need to follow CDC guidelines when we're out in the woods, also maintaining social distancing and so on. The last principle involves respecting wildlife. So that's a big one as well, because with a lot of high use in our wilderness, we do have folks camping near water sources and too close to the water. And as we all know, wildlife uses water as well. Just thinking about some of the ways that you can minimize your impacts on wildlife, maybe not visiting during a sensitive time of year when species are mating. Keeping your pet on a leash is another way to minimize impacts on wildlife. So again, the Leave No Trace program is very broad, and it does drill down to specific areas, specific recreation pursuits. So you can always go to their website, which is www.lnt.org, and get more information that way. We also have Leave No Trace information on our website for the Hoosier National Forest.
What's different about wilderness in the eastern U.S. versus out west?
Well, in general, it's all the same. I mean, it's all congressionally designated wilderness areas. There's over 440 designated wilderness areas throughout the country. But what makes eastern wilderness a little bit more unique is that it's typically surrounded by a more urban environment in general than what out west wilderness experiences. So again, being in Indiana with only 4% public land and only 13,000 acres of designated wilderness, it gets a lot of pressure and a lot of use. Whereas out west, you could go for days potentially in wilderness areas and not encounter anyone. So that's something folks need to consider when visiting as well. And you know, we encourage folks to come out more so on weekdays or earlier in the day. Our wilderness has been absolutely packed on the weekends, really throughout the whole summer, but more so right now with leaf season. So just something to plan ahead and prepare for, that you may not get a parking spot. And some may say, well, why don't you just have more parking? Well, it goes back to the carrying capacity of our wilderness and meeting that Wilderness Act of 1964, providing opportunities for solitude. So our parking is designed for carrying capacity needs of our wilderness area. So if that trailhead is full, you're expected to go somewhere else.
And you maintain a mule team for the wilderness, correct?
We do, yes.
Yeah. What is that like?
Well, we have a mule team of four mules. We have the only stock program in the eastern half of the United States for the Forest Service. So it's very, very unique. We're very happy and pleased that we're able to maintain that program. But the idea is, because wilderness areas do not allow for motorized or mechanized equipment, whether it be from a recreational standpoint or a maintenance standpoint, instead, we utilize our mules during parts of the season for various activities such as packing in trail maintenance supplies, patrolling needs, or even building new trail. So it's a very unique program. And as mentioned earlier, Rod Fall is our wilderness ranger. He does an outstanding job maintaining our program, and he also participates in typically a once a year detail to our neighboring national forest, the Shawnee National Forest in Illinois. They have 7 wilderness areas, and our mules and Rod go over there typically a month out of the year to do maintenance work with our mule team over there as well.
How'd you get into this? There's always a fun story there.
There is always a fun story there. I'm going to make my dad proud because he was very good, my mom as well, but very good at indicating that you need to go for a career that you enjoy and that you have a natural passion for. Obviously, you spend a lot of time in your job, so it was really indicated to me at a young age to think about things that I naturally enjoy and want to get involved in. And I've always been very close to nature and the woods and outdoor recreation. Grew up snow skiing and water skiing and hiking and camping and all that good stuff. So I guess I'm just one of the lucky ones that was able to get a job doing something that, you know, typically most days is just an outstanding career.
Stacy Duke is a wilderness manager for the Hoosier National Forest, and she, along with wilderness ranger Rod Fall, were recently recognized nationally with the Bob Marshall Award for Individual Champion of Wilderness Stewardship. Stacy, congrats again, and thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. Enjoyed talking to you.
And now, more about staffing issues within Indiana's prison system. Jake Harper with Side Effects Public Media has been reporting on this. Good afternoon, Jake.
Hey, Matt.
So we've talked to you before about staffing at the Indiana Women's Prison. I recall from that conversation that even though we were talking about their problems with staffing, you said it was worse elsewhere in the prison system. Can you just give us an overview before we start of the problem in Indiana's prison system?
Yeah, so the Indiana Department of Correction has had staffing issues for years. The latest report we have available is from August. So that month, the department reported there were about 5,200 employees total, but also 1,200 open positions across the adult prisons in the state. During the pandemic, there have been large numbers of people leaving too, at least 175 people left in August. And after that first story ran, the department actually raised the base pay for new officers to try to bring more people in. It used to be $16 an hour, and now it's $19.
Your most recent report looks at one particular facility. Which prison are we talking about?
The prison I looked at is called the Miami Correctional Facility. It's located in Miami County, Bunker Hill, actually, the location of an old military base. So it's about 70 miles north of Indianapolis, and it holds a little under 3,000 men.
How many people do they have working there versus how many should be there?
That's a great question. So prisons can do something called a staffing analysis, which determines how many people they need to keep a prison running safely. I actually asked for that number. The Department of Correction said they have done those analyses, but the spokesperson would not tell me what the number was, how many people the prison needs. Actually, the department didn't really respond to much of what was in the story. What I can say is that about 5 years ago, the prison had about 400 custody staff, so officers, sergeants, and other people who are responsible for the safety and security. That latest report I mentioned earlier showed that they're down to about 266. Wow. So that's about 2/3 of what they used to have.
Why are so many officers leaving?
So for this story, I spoke to 8 former staff. From what they told me, it's the environment. And the turnover or low staffing issue can really become sort of a cycle. So when you have so few officers to keep the peace, a prison can become a more violent place. So this former staff told me stabbings happen all the time. Prisoners attack each other or go after the officers. The culture of the prison seemed to push people to treat inmates harshly. So that harsh inmate treatment actually led some people to leave too. And at the same time, the staff said they didn't feel supported by the leadership at the prison. A couple even said they remembered being told directly that they were replaceable. So all those issues sort of feed off of each other and can spiral out of control. And the pandemic certainly hasn't helped things.
What kind of toll is this taking on the officers who are still working?
So being a correctional officer is one of the hardest jobs there is, and it's really bad for your health, it turns out. Officers can suffer from physical conditions like heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes. They also have really high rates of mental health issues, anxiety and depression, PTSD. And suicide rates are way higher for correctional officers than they are for the general population. And actually two former officers I spoke with said that they had thought seriously or even attempted suicide partly because of the stress of the job.
And is the leadership doing anything about it?
Not much from what I heard. So these are anecdotes, but one guy who mentioned that he had thoughts of harming himself, he described a conversation with his captain. And he said the captain laughed at him and basically said he was making excuses to get out of work. He ended up quitting because the department wouldn't let him take unpaid time off to do intensive therapy. So his choice was basically do therapy or keep working at this job. And he decided to go with the therapy. Another guy I spoke with said he had a conversation with the warden after he tried to kill himself. And the warden basically told him to toughen up and stop acting like a girl. So those are really unfortunate responses to something that's a serious, well-documented issue among prison workers.
Jake Harper is a reporter for Side Effects Public Media, which is a public health news collaborative based out of our flagship station, WFYI, in Indianapolis. Jake, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Up next, just in time for Halloween, a new Audible original lecture series covers the life and works of Edgar Allan Poe. The English professor behind the series is also the executive vice chancellor for academic affairs at IU Kokomo. He's up next. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Tomorrow is Halloween. One way to consider marking the occasion might be the new Audible original called Edgar Allan Poe, Master of Horror. The author is IU Kokomo English professor Mark Canada, and he joins me now. Mark, welcome.
Thanks, Matt. Nice to be here.
Great timing on this, of course. But how would you describe it? Is it an audiobook? Is it a podcast, a lecture series? What is this?
Well, I thought of it as a lecture series, but it reads a lot like a book. Each one of the chapters is about a half an hour long, so it's good for commutes, or you can binge listen, I suppose, if you like. But it covers just about everything you'd like to know about Poe, at least the highlights. So I give an introduction to Poe and his reputation and where he fits in American culture and in American literature, and go on and talk a bit about his life and then several of his works, his horror works, as well as several others. And then I take a look at his legacy.
How long have you been a student of Edgar Allan Poe's work?
Well, it's funny how I got started. I'm unlike a lot of people who are interested in Poe in the sense that I was not involved with him as a young man. I was really more interested in reading books about baseball, so I didn't get to Poe until later. But when I got to graduate school, I had recently read a book by Carl Sagan called Dragons of Eden, in which he discussed the number of things, including the divided brain, the right side and the left side of the brain. And I just kind of filed it away and was studying Poe and was noticing some really striking resemblances between what Sagan had written about the right brain and what Poe was writing, and then became very interested in Poe. So that was some 25 years ago when I was in graduate school, and I've remained interested in him ever since.
What did you explore on his brain? That's lecture number 4 in the series, right?
Yes, there was a lot of interest on the side of the producer for me to explore that part. So like many scholars, I know quite a bit about various aspects of Poe's life and work and so on and so forth. As literary scholars, we know the breadth, but we tend to zero in on some things of particular interest to us. And that was the one that was of particular interest to me. And so I've done quite a bit of research on that aspect of his brain. And so, for example, we know that the right brain is heavily involved with things such as negative emotions. And if you know anything about Poe, that's probably the one thing you know, is that he was a writer of not only horror fiction, but also very sad poetry. The two great examples, of course, are Annabel Lee and The Raven. But he tended to appeal to those sides of our personality. In fact, he wrote in his essay, The Philosophy of Composition, in which he supposedly was writing about how he wrote The Raven, he explained that the death of a beautiful woman is the most poetical subject. And that can be read as kind of a misogynist statement, but I don't think Poe meant it that way. I think what he meant was that beauty and love are something we treasure deeply, and the loss of that is something that's bound to instill sadness in our hearts. And so he was going after that. So he wrote actually in that same essay that he was trying to create an effect with his writing. He said he likes to commence with the consideration of an effect. And so what did he mean by that? Well, I think he wanted to try to evoke an emotional response in us. And the right brain is the part of our brains that processes negative emotions. So that's just one example. There are many others as well. We know that the right brain tends to play an important role in imagery, and particularly dreams and surreal imagery. Now, I'm oversimplifying a bit here, but the patterns are pretty striking that the right brain tends to process those things. And if you know Poe's work at all, you know that he does a lot with very visual imagery. And so one of the striking examples of that is a story that's very timely, in fact, too timely for us today. It's called The Mask of the Red Death, which is about a pestilence. And of course, we're living through a pestilence right now, and thank heavens it's not the kind of pestilence he described, which is a very deadly pestilence. But the point I want to make is that in that story, he emphasizes and really captures a lot of very striking images. And throughout his work, there's a lot of really strong imagery. One of his stories, it's not as well known, but it's one of his masterworks called Lygia. And in Lygia, he describes Lygia's face and spends about 1,000 words just describing her face. So clearly, an interest in imagery was very important to Poe. And then the dreamlike quality of his work, of course, is very striking. In a number of his stories, The Fall of House the Usher comes to mind. The Pit and the Pendulum, obviously, is very surreal. So all of those different pieces, I think, really point to a side of him that was very active, at least on the right side of his brain. And I would argue what he was trying to do is reach out and touch us and speak to us in kind of a right brain language, because he knew that he could evoke a very emotional, even visceral response by writing in this right brain language, by evoking these very powerful, surreal imagery, images and evoking strong negative emotions. And probably the most striking aspect of that right brain language that he uses is one that's not nearly as well known, and it's very speculative, so I don't know that the neurologists have decided on this one yet, but there's some speculation that the right brain may play a kind of role a little bit like Freud's notion of the unconscious, in the sense that it's kind of a repressed entity that may even be responsible for some of the self-destructive urges you see in some of us when we do exactly the opposite of what we think we should do. And that particular parallel was particularly striking to me because Poe wrote extensively about exactly that urge. And he named it perverseness, or the imp of the perverse, by which he meant doing the opposite of what we knew what was good for us. And he wrote about that in The Black Cat. He wrote a story called The Imp of the Perverse. It's striking in The Raven, in which the person supposedly delivering the poem keeps asking the bird exactly the questions that would evoke the response nevermore. And that's the last thing he should want to hear when he asks, am I ever going to see my love again? Nevermore. And that's the pattern that carries on in the poem. So that self-destructiveness is pervasive in his literature. And it's really striking when you think about the role that the right brain may be playing.
You talk about evoking reactions, and at just the mention of The Pit and the Pendulum, I'm like flashing back to high school. Yes. And having read that story had such a deep impact on me, just as an aside. So I guess just so we have an idea of the man behind the work, what was his life like?
Well, funny we should come to that subject now, because I was talking about these self-destructive urges, and that's really the most striking aspect of Poe's life. But let me start with just the overall sadness of his life. This was a man who was orphaned by the time he was 3 years old. His father had abandoned him and his mother, and then his mother died young. They were both itinerant actors. They'd been traveling around. She dies in Richmond, and as luck would have it, it was somewhat good luck, somewhat bad luck. He was taken in by the Allens, and that's where the name Allen comes from. That's not his middle name. That's the name of John Allen and Frances Allen, the couple who never adopted him, but did take him in and foster him. And he did have an attachment to his foster mother, Frances, but she was fairly sickly and wasn't able to give him the love that he would have liked. And she died prematurely, like so many different women in his life, his own mother, this woman, Frances, a kind of surrogate mother named Jane Stannard, for whom he supposedly wrote a poem called To Helen. And then finally, his wife, Virginia, died young. And so he lost literally every woman he ever loved, with the exception of his aunt, and that would be Virginia's mother, whom he called Muddy, Mariah Clem. So he lost a lot of people in his life, and his foster father supported him, but mainly in a financial way, and not always to Poe's liking. He didn't get the same support he would have liked. His foster father tended to be kind of a rough, not really rough, but more like a tough, pull yourself up by your bootstraps type of father, and Poe was more of a tender soul, and so that didn't bode well. Coming from that background, he struggled economically throughout his life. Back then, it was very difficult to make a living as an author. There were only a few authors who could do that, and so he had to turn to editing and did not make a great living, but at least was able to feed himself in Virginia from his income from being an editor. But throughout all of this, he did not have a lot working to his advantage and had to rely on others, and then would, back to the self-destructive urges, he continually would alienate people, would make enemies of people. One of the great writers of the time period was Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Poe inexplicably, and I'm not sure anybody understands why, out of the blue, decides that Longfellow was a plagiarist and wages this long war on Longfellow, this beloved poet, with no basis, calling him a plagiarist. This is the kind of thing that Poe did again and again and again. He had a self-destructive streak, and I think that's why he wrote about it, because he knew it from his own life.
Mm. And it came back to bite him in death, as I understand, which we will definitely get to in a bit.
Yes.
We're talking with IU Kokomo English professor Mark Canada, who wrote the new Audible original called Edgar Allan Poe, Master of Horror. It's out now, right, Mark?
Yes, it came out just a few days ago. Audible wanted to get it out in time for Halloween. So, yes, the timing is very good.
Yeah. And so let's go to some of the works that aren't as well known. I mean, we've all read The Raven, The Telltale Heart. Some of us think we know Edgar Allan Poe, but there's a lot in here that you cover that isn't as well known. What are some examples?
Well, thanks for asking, because I think people do mistakenly think he was only a writer of horror. The reality is that he turned to horror because he knew that it sold. And it's a little funny to think about it, because Poe, in some ways, was a very purist writer. He considered himself a poet. And when he began writing, his first three books were all books of poetry. Beginning in 1827, he came out with book after book of poetry, but they didn't fly, they didn't sell, he didn't get a reception, even the critics ignored them. At some point, he realized that horror fiction would sell. It was very popular back then. There was a magazine called Blackwood's Magazine that published a lot of horror. And so he turned to writing fiction, turned away from the poetry, wrote almost exclusively fiction for a decade or more, and was writing a lot of that horror literature. But as you said, he dabbled in other writings as well. In 1841, he came out with a story called The Murders in the Rue Morgue, which is not nearly as well known as you said, The Raven or The Telltale Heart. But it was probably the most influential thing he ever wrote, because it was the world's first detective story. So when we think about all of the suspense movies we have today, and the CSI and the police shows and the murder mysteries, all of that, every last bit of it goes back to Edgar Allan Poe. So even Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, of course, who's best known for Sherlock Holmes, delivered an homage to Poe when he wrote one of his works of Sherlock Holmes, recognizing that Poe really was the father of detective fiction. On top of that, he also was a pioneer of science fiction. He wrote a couple of stories that could be considered early versions of science fiction. This is long before Jules Verne and long before Ray Bradbury, who was also a big fan of Poe. So he was able to craft entirely new genre on his own. And in that sense, he was extremely influential, as well as what he did for criticism. He was probably the greatest critic of the 19th century, if not of all of American literature.
A lot of people think he was a crazy person. Is there evidence for that?
Well, yes and no. I guess it depends on how you define crazy. let me start by saying he was not the madman that he was made out to be by Rufus Griswold, who wrote a damning obituary of him. And again, we talk about Poe being very self-destructive. Well, one of the things he did is make an enemy of Rufus Griswold. He made an enemy of a number of people, but it was particularly a bad idea to make an enemy of Rufus Griswold because, number one, he was a petty man, and number two, he was a fairly powerful man in the world of, in the literary circles of the day. So when he had a chance to, Griswold wrote this damning obituary where he made Poe out to be not only a madman, but also a drunk and a wife beater and everything else he could think of. Poe did have trouble with alcohol, I will concede that, but he certainly was a loving husband. There's no evidence to suggest otherwise. He was not a madman. He had perfect control of his life in many respects. And people who wrote about him said he was genteel, he was soft-spoken, he was very likable, he was a fine conversationalist, he was a fine human being. But the more complex answer is that even though he was not a madman, he did seem to suffer from some form of mental illness. There's a book I really treasure called written by Kay Redfield Jamison, who writes about bipolar disorder in a number of writers. And I think she makes a very compelling case that Poe did suffer from bipolar disorder, which he wrote about himself. He didn't call it that, but he did suggest that he did experience feelings of being very active in his thought and his writing, but also times when he would feel that he was unable to write. And so he clearly did have those kinds of feelings of a bipolar disorder. So he did suffer from some mental illness, but there's no evidence to suggest that he was a madman.
There is some mystery behind his death. What do we know?
Well, we know that he mysteriously stopped in Baltimore as he was traveling north. We don't know for certain why he was going north. He had lost his wife, Virginia, by that time, so he may have been trying to go and pick up her mother, Muddy. Again, that was his beloved aunt. But for some reason, on his way from Richmond going up to going north, he stopped in Baltimore and was found semi-conscious in apparently someone else's clothes. So you can imagine all the mystery around this, and there's been all kinds of speculation about why he stopped there and why he was so dreadfully ill, why he was semi-conscious. But in any case, he dies just a few days later. And mysteriously is crying the name Reynolds. We don't know exactly who Reynolds was. There was a person named Reynolds who'd written a book that he may have been inspired by, but no one knows what the cause of death was. And again, we don't know why he even stopped in Baltimore. He did have trouble with alcohol. He had recently taken a temperance pledge, and that was not new to him, but he claimed he was going to try to get off of the alcohol. But he may have been undergoing delirium tremens. He may have been undergoing some kind of withdrawal. He may have actually been, and this is a very timely subject, he may have been a victim of something that was going on at the time period. It was election day, and there was a habit back then that some people would go around and beat people up and take them around to vote. As kind of an immoral type of voting ploy. And Poe actually was not well known enough to be a celebrity, so he may have actually just been picked up by some thugs and taken around to vote. No one knows exactly why. Lots of speculation. Maybe he died of carbon monoxide poisoning. People have speculated he died of rabies. People have speculated a number of different reasons. So no one really knows why Poe died in 1849.
And in our last 30 seconds, and I hate to only give you that amount of time to answer this, but do you have a favorite Edgar Allan Poe story?
My favorite is definitely The Purloined Letter, which is not really as well known, but it is his masterwork when it comes to his detective fiction. It's very complex, dense. It's not horrible at all, so it doesn't fit in the regular genre he's known for, but it is a work of complexity and brilliance.
Oh, glad to hear it. Mark Canada is Executive Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs and a professor of English at IU Kokomo. He's also out with a new Audible original lecture series called Edgar Allan Poe, Master of Horror. And we didn't get to this, but he'll be presenting tonight at a virtual event called A Night with Poe, put on by the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library in Indianapolis. Mark, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Nice talking with you, Matt.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Happy Halloween. This is All In.